And let us turn once again to the fourth chapter of Peter's first epistle. First epistle of Peter in chapter 4. And reading once more and for the last time at this present time, the portion beginning in verse 12. The first epistle of Peter in chapter 4, the verse that we look at is the last verse of the chapter, verse 19, but beginning to read in verse 12. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy. If ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but in your part he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. Yet if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. For the time is come that judgment must begin at the house of God. And if it first begin at us, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing, as unto a faithful Creator. We come now to this concluding statement of the Apostle Peter concerning this question of suffering for righteousness' sake, the subject that he has been dealing with in this second part of this fourth chapter of his epistle. We may remember that he has first of all exhorted his readers not to think it strange concerning the fiery trial of persecution that is about to try them. And then he has gone on to expound to them something of the truth of this business of being called upon, if need be, to suffer in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ and for the cause of his gospel. Christ himself, of course, has suffered, and what they are being called to be are partakers of that suffering of Christ. That in itself is probably one of the most tremendous thoughts in the whole of Peter's exposition of the question of suffering in the cause of the gospel. It's also a blessed thing, he is told, is to be reproached for the name of Christ. And indeed, it's a very evidence that the Spirit of glory and of God is resting upon us. A person is not to be ashamed if he or she is called upon to suffer as a Christian. And indeed, says Peter, we are rather to glorify God on this behalf. As we said, the very name Christ, Messiah, the Anointed, the Appointed One, is all bound up with the question of suffering, as we'll see soon in our sermons in the book of Genesis. Thou shalt bruise his heel, and he shall bruise thy head. And the very name Anointed conjures up suffering for the Christ, the Anointed, the Appointed One of God, who was to come and bring salvation to us. Small wonder, then, if the name Christian, by which we are called, entitles us to suffer a while, as the apostle would put it in another place, until we are one day made perfect, like the captain of our salvation. So last week, then, we looked at verses 17 and 18, and what appears to be one great overall explanation with regards to this business of being persecuted for righteousness' sake and in the cause of the gospel. For the time has come, says Peter, that judgment must begin at the house of God. And if it first begin at us, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? It is God's hand upon his church, as we said. That's the great and the ultimate explanation of every time of persecution, of hardship, of perplexity that the Church of Christ is called to pass through in so many generations and in so many ages of her existence. He acts as a father with his children, and as a Father who deserves the name at all, being a reflection of our Father God in heaven, as a Father guides and directs and chides and chastises his children, turns them away from wrong ways and endeavours to turn them into right ways, so the Lord does this in exactly the same way with his children, the church. For he rightly knows how to rear up his own children. Not as we would think we ought to be reared up, for we're the children, but as the Father knows how to rear up the children. For the time has come that judgment must begin at the house of God, the household of God. And the church of Christ is the household of God at this present time. And as we saw the priority of things, even in the Old Testament, with the Old Testament people of God, it was always a beginning at his sanctuary, with his people, with Israel, with his city. He always began there before his general judgments were wrought out in all the world. So the beginning of the judgment is always here, now, in time, temporally, with the people of God, with the church of God, with the household of God. But then he asks the question, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel? He sets the one against the other. He reminds us and will remind us that whatever we are called to pass through here as the people of God, that's nothing to be compared with that judgment that is stored up for them that obey not the gospel. The two parties are believers and unbelievers, the righteous and the unrighteous, the converted and the unconverted. And Peter by no means would want us to rejoice, far from it, in the end of them that obey not the gospel. At the same time, he would want us to hold our temporal things aright and see that when all said and done, it's small suffering, whatever it is, that we're called to pass through in this world if we're the people of God, in comparison with that that is stored up for them that obey not the gospel. As we said, it's the afterwards that Paul speaks about. No chastisement for the present seems to be joyous but grievous, but afterwards it yieldeth the peaceable fruits of righteousness. And Peter's dealing with the eternal afterwards. Now we suffer, we bear the cross, if you like, with Christ here below, but afterwards comes the peaceable fruit of righteousness. He throws that into stark relief for us by asking those two questions. What shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel? Where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? No answers are given. The answers are obvious, all too obvious. They ought to be all the more obvious to the hearts of those who profess to believe the whole truth of God, and thus believing it and knowing such a truth, then they take what God calls them to pass through in this present time, in the spirit in which they ought to take it. So, as we say, the great overriding word with regards to this very trial is this, that when all said and done, it's God's hand, for, you see, that's the key word, for the time has come that judgment must begin at the house of God. The first word of our verse for this morning is wherefore. That's Peter now gathering up all that he has said to us and applying it to us. But you see, he's setting our feet on the foundation which he has been building all along. But that verse 17 and verse 18, that's the last layer of the foundation. That's the finishing, that's the solid piece of cement right on the top. When he has told us it all, here's the ultimate explanation of all the fiery trial. For, because, the time has come that judgment must begin at the house of God. And when he has put down the last layer of the foundation for our feet, only then does he invite us to set our feet upon the foundation that he has laid. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God, and so forth. He builds bit by bit, layer by layer, until he comes to the last bit. Then he invites us to stand upon the foundation that he has laid with regards to this truth of suffering for righteousness' sake. Well, let's look at the words then for this morning. We'll simply take them more or less phrase by phrase as they're set out for us in the verse, the whole verse, first of all. Wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing, as unto a faithful Creator. Wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God. And obviously, you see, when Peter begins, wherefore, he no doubt believes that he is given to us, to his readers, to these particular readers, to all generations of Christians that shall ever come. He believes that he has given them more than enough by way of doctrine, by way of explanation, by way of lesson, with regards to this truth about not being amazed at those things that come upon them in the will of the Lord. Don't you see what he's exhorting us to now, here in this last verse? He's exhorting us, my friends, to the very opposite that he exhorted us to at the beginning of the section. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. Now, you see, he's telling us the complete opposite to that. There he's exhorting us not to be amazed, not to be astonished, not to be in turmoil. But now he's telling us the same truth, but from the positive side. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator. It's a complete opposite from being amazed or astonished. It's absolute calmness, it's absolute solidarity that he's exhorting us to then, to stand up boldly in the face of all the opposition, committing our souls in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator. But he does this, don't you see, on the back of all that he has told us concerning this business of suffering for righteousness' sake. And if he now comes to tell us that, then obviously, as we say, Peter believes he has told us enough to make us do that, to make us commit our souls in the midst of suffering or hardship or persecution into the hands of our God. Peter obviously believes that he has told us enough of the truth concerning this business of being persecuted for righteousness' sake, and if it's not enough, then what is going to be enough? Christ has suffered. My dear friends, we can't even be called Christians, Christ's ones, unless we are going to experience something of the suffering of the gospel as it flows from us, from the one who brought the gospel to our hearts in the first place. Once the Holy Spirit of God is infused into us by the grace of God, it sets us in complete contradiction to the things of the world and the flesh and the devil. There's bound to be conflict. And right through all the things that Peter has told us, he has told us that, and he has obviously told us enough. And if we can't take all the exposition of the truth of suffering for righteousness' sake that Peter has set before us now, then we'll never have enough, because he has given us a full body of divinity with regards to the thing. And when we're called upon to suffer in any way, inside, outside, with the assaults of our own flesh or the devil or the world or anything, when we're called to suffer for righteousness' sake, we're to go into all that truth, all the parts of it. Then we embrace the wherefore to our souls, and we commit our souls unto the God who, when all's said and done, knows all about the suffering that we're passing through. Don't you see the phrase that he uses? It's very applicable, especially perhaps in the light of the last truth about God's hand being upon his church as a father's hand upon the children that he loves. Wherefore, he says, let them that suffer according to the will of God. My, here are Christians suffering. Here are Christians about to be tied to the stake and burned. It is the will of God, says Peter. No more Blue Mondays? What kind of a gospel is that, pray tell? Here is the will of God for his dear blood-bought church, the apple of his eye, the dearest thing to him apart from his own dear son walking this world to redeem his church. It's the will of God, the fiery trial that is about to try you. And how we need our Christian thinking revolutionized in this day, when it's so easy to be at ease in Zion and imagine that we have God's smile of approval upon our lethargy. Here's the situation. What comes upon them ultimately? God wills it, or permits it in his will at least, to come upon them. Simon, Simon, as we saw last week, you remember, because Peter's writing this whole epistle out of his experience with Christ on the earth in so many ways. Simon, Simon, Satan hath desired to have thee that he might sift you. You remember the sifting, the shaking. You remember how the Lord uses the same kind of an illustration with regards to his blessing. Like a man that takes very fine grain and shakes it all together so that it settles, so that you get more blessing. Well, on the other extreme, Satan's going to do that with Peter with regards to suffering. Going to shake him and sift him so that there's going to be suffering upon suffering upon suffering. But he's not going to be sifted beyond what God permits in his will for Peter. Nor is dear old Job going to have one more boil on his neck or his back or his legs or his feet than God permits there to be. And he is faithful, a faithful creator, Peter calls him. He is faithful, says Paul, will not permit you to be tempted above that that you're able, but will with the temptation also make the way of escape. But withal, he permits the extent of persecution upon his own church. And here, when they enter the trials and their suffering, they're to bear this in mind above all other things: wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God. One of those paradoxes, you see, yet a paradox of the Christian life that you must grasp, that the same hand that guides is the same hand that comes heavy very often. But the very heaviness of the hand is the guiding of the hand as well in the rearing up of his own children. Read it. Digest it, hold it, bury it in your heart. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God. According to the will of God. And that fiery trial, how are they to see it? According to the will of God. For the thing that Peter's going to exhort them to do is this. He's going to exhort them to commit their souls unto God in the midst of the fiery trial. Well, how will they commit their souls unto God in the midst of the fiery trial unless they are first of all persuaded that the fiery trial is in the hand of God also? How will they do that? How can you commit anything sincerely with conviction into a hand unless you are persuaded that it is an omnipotent and a sovereign hand that holds your life and your breath in it, and all pertaining to your life and your breath? Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit their souls unto him. It's the same as the Apostle Paul, of course, because the Bible is all the same, really, when all's said and done. Commit simply means to deposit something that's precious or something that's valuable. The Bible uses it in two ways. Something that's committed to or something that's committed by. So there are some things that are committed to us by God. There are some things that are committed by us to God. Paul uses both of them when he's writing to Timothy. O Timothy, he says, keep that which is committed to thy trust. What was that? That was the gospel. God had committed the gospel to Timothy. What an honor, my friends. What a valuable thing. What grace of God that he commits this valuable thing of the gospel of his truth into the hands of men, into the church of Jesus Christ, his son. God commits something to us, but we commit some things to God. So says Paul, for the which cause I also suffer these things, nevertheless I am not ashamed. For I know who I am, believe it, and I'm persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. That's his soul that he's committed unto God. And he's persuaded that God is able to keep his soul. You know the nice story about the old man who was asked what his persuasion was, his religious persuasion. And he said, I'm of Paul's persuasion. What's that? Well, he says, I am persuaded that God is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. Paul was persuaded, but my friends, nice and all as the story is, don't lose the force of what Paul says and where Paul says it. And Paul speaks his words of persuasiveness out of the heat of being persecuted for righteousness' sake. Where's Paul when he writes to Timothy in the second epistle? He's in Rome, in prison, in his own hired house, you say? No, not in his own hired house. That was his first imprisonment. And his second imprisonment is something that's entirely different to his first. And he's in a bottleneck dungeon such as they had in Rome in his second epistle. And no man has stood by him. And all them that are of Asia, the Christians, mark you, of Asia, they have forsaken him. And the mighty apostle Paul writes to this young man, Timothy, and listen to these words, my friends, and be humbled. Be not therefore ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, he says, nor of me his prisoner. What a word. The mightiest of the mighty among the sons of men. Paul, the apostle of the Lord. And he writes to this young stripling of a minister. And he says, Timothy, don't be ashamed of me. Don't be ashamed. In Asia, they're ashamed of me. In Rome, they're ashamed of me. I'm in the very bottleneck of despair. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed. Don't you see? And why is he not ashamed? Because I am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. What day? The day of the immortality of his soul. For through the appearing of Christ and his gospel, he says, he has brought light and immortality to pass. And his soul, you see, is up there, committed, deposited with God. So what of men? And what of dungeons? And what of opinions? And what of his dearest friends, even Timothy? Don't be ashamed of me, Timothy. But the undertone's there. Even if you're ashamed of me, I am not ashamed of the gospel. And he's persuaded because of his commitment. And Peter, you see, they're evil days. And it's especially in evil days that the believers need to know something of the casting of their souls into the hands of God.
Peter knew himself. Again, he's writing out of experience. You remember when the Lord told him how they would take him away and gird him and lead him in the ways that he didn't want to go. This spake Jesus, signifying by what death Peter should glorify him. By what death he should glorify him. And Peter knew the hand of God, the permitted will of God, the will of God in all his sufferings. Why, Christ had told him the will of God. He has showed me how I must put off this my tabernacle. He knew it. Nobody needed to tell him then that it was the will of God that he must suffer for righteousness' sake. It's not fatalism, of course. The gospel, Calvinism, for that's the gospel when all's said and done. Not fatalism. Don't mix it up with fatalism. That's Arminianism doing whatever it likes to do. That's very different, my friends. And you lift up your heart and have every right to do it and every ill circumstance that comes upon you, and you cry out unto the Lord, Lord, change these circumstances. But at the same time, you must come back to the will of God when these circumstances obviously are not being changed. As the poet puts it, still raise to heaven the supplicated voice, but leave to God the measure and the choice. Wherefore, let them that suffer, how? According to the will of God. That's Christianity. That's Christianity, my friends. Now let's look and see exactly what it is that we are to commit into the hands of God, as it were. And of course, it's our souls. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him. Surely that's a good word in the present context. All believers, of course, to be believers in the first place, have committed their souls to God, have deposited their souls with God. They go on depositing their souls with God. I trust we do that. I'm sure we do. From day to day, my friends, we commit our souls into the safe keeping of God until when it comes to the hour of death itself, such as would appear to be soon facing these people. We commit that last great act of faith at the last moment, as it were, when we finally, as it were, commit our souls unto God. You see, throughout Peter's epistle, in these latter verses, Christ is set before us, is he not? To be emulated, to be imitated, insofar as we can, as mortal fallen men saved by grace. And did Christ not do that very thing at the very last, when he had finished all the work, when he had done his day, when it was night time, as it were? Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Stephen did it, the first of the martyrs in the Acts of the Apostles. These people are going into a martyr situation. Well, let them hold on to this, that they commit their souls unto God now. It's an exercise that belongs to them at the present time, from day to day, from moment to moment, if you like, so that being experienced in the exercise, when the actual hour comes, then they're able to do it automatically, as you might say, and do it to the praise of the Lord. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him. You know, my friends, I don't suppose any of us think enough about our souls. And that's the truth. None of us, converted or unconverted. Because I'll tell you how you'll prove that to yourself. Draw up two charts. Draw up one with regards to time and energy and percentage of interest. devoted to the body and the things of the body, and one devoted to the soul and the things of the soul. See that in a very short time, your chart concerning the body will soon run right off and up to the ceiling. And you'll hardly get past the first few degrees when it comes to the soul. Is that not right? I'll tell you how you'll prove it to yourself. Reflect your own attitude to your own soul in the attitude to the soul of your child. Remember what Mr. Ryle said. Care for that part of your child that shall never die. The soul. Now when it comes to our children, we want to see them strong and healthy in body. Rightly so. We want to see them getting on. We want to see them educated. We want to see them getting a position. All these things, rightly so, but rightly held. Not a betrayal as to how we regard our souls, our own souls, when the percentage is so cumbered on the other side with our children's well-being and temporal, earthly, bodily things in comparison to the well-being of their never-dying souls. Yet that's the issue. What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And Peter goes right to the heart of the matter, goes to the soul. You remember that time when old Roland Hill had gone out into Moorland's Common to preach? There was a great crowd there in the open air meeting. And along came that woman, Lady Anne Erskine, in a very fine carriage and pair. And she stopped, and of course all eyes turned to Lady Anne Erskine. Dear old Roland Hill decided that he would take up the opportunity. And so he turned his eyes towards her and he said, "Let us conduct an auction. The article offered is the soul of Lady Anne Erskine, and there are three bidders. The world offers riches, honours and pleasure. The devil offers all the kingdoms of this earth and the glory of them. The Lord Jesus offers grace here and glory hereafter. Who shall have the soul of Lady Anne Erskine?" My friends, be sure that auction goes on. Be sure that the devil will go on bidding for our souls till the end of the day. Be sure that we are right with God. What shall it profit? It's the soul. You see what Peter's been setting out before us? These storms, these fiery trials, these persecutions. You see what's happening to the church and happens to the church. God's hand comes upon her. But God's hand comes upon her in time, touching, as it were, these temporal, bodily, tangible things, but not touching the soul. It's like the wheat and the chaff, like the man with the winnowing fork. You know how he throws the wheat and the chaff up together? The chaff gets again all shaken about, all upheaved, but the wheat, my friends, falls to the ground. The wind doesn't blow it away, it blows away the chaff into the fire that the man has kindled over against the place where he's working. That's the picture, whose fan is in his hand. And the Lord might indeed upheave the wheat of his people, but the chaff is blown away. It's their souls that they're to commit. And as I say, it's a good word, surely. Let me tell you a story, very simple story, about a Greek soldier. It comes from history, from Greek history. And this soldier did many brave deeds. He was always in the heat of the battle. Wherever the battle raged fiercest, there was this particular soldier. It made people wonder, because he wasn't a very strong man. He was quite weak. He was very sickly. He was ill almost every day. And yet he was right there in the heat of the battle, wherever the battle raged most, there was that soldier. And the people wondered. Then he went to the physicians one day, and he began a course of treatment, and he was cured from his illness. Then people began to see that he didn't throw himself into the heat of the battle as he used to do. And he was questioned about it. And his reply was very simple, very profound and telling. Before, he said, I venture nothing but a diseased corpse. Now it is otherwise with me, for I have somewhat to lose. Ah, yes. My friend, you get the body and the soul wrong, and your Christian warfare falls to pieces. Once you see the body as a diseased corpse indeed, then you venture nothing as far as this world's concerned. But once you get into an upside down situation, and the body is uppermost on top of the things of the never dying soul, then you think you have somewhat to lose with regards to the things of this world. And where's the fight and the good fight of faith? The bodies. Remember, Peter started his exhortations a way back. And who is he that will harm you if you be followers of that which is good? But and if you suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are ye. And be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled. What's their terror? Their terror is the things that would terrorize them, touching their body and their temporal things. Don't be terrorized with their terror. Let them touch the body. If the soul is in the hands of God, my friends, don't you see the strength of it? If the never-dying soul is in the hand of God, ultimately, it matters little if the body falls into the hands of the worst of men, if the soul is already committed into the hand of God. That's what he's saying. That's what he's telling these people on the eve of persecution. Surely he's telling it no less to us, to weigh it up in our hearts and our minds, for our own present time, however it applies to us. One other word quickly with regards to that before we move to the last statement. You see, there's a condition of the commitment attached to the commitment, namely well-doing. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator. Oh, yes, says somebody, I'm of Paul's persuasion. By that they mean that they decided to become a Christian 10, 20, 30 years ago, and now I'm eternally secure and I shall never be lost. Rubbish. Rubbish, my friends. Words mean nothing, don't you know? A man will never be saved by works, but if a man doesn't have Christian works, he's not saved. It's as simple as that. The Bible is as simple and as clear as that. Read Paul, read James together. Neither of them clash. Both of them augment one another in the fullness of the gospel. And if I will commit my soul to God, I'll commit my soul to God in well-doing. Peter's writing to these saints, don't you remember? These saints, some of them about to be tied to the martyr stake. And he's exhorting them to get on with their Christian work and their Christian testimony. And up we'll come in our day and we'll plead excuses and reasons for not doing the things that God has told us to do. Let me read you Proverbs again. If thou sayest, behold, we knew it not, Doth not he that pondereth the heart considereth? And he that keepeth thy soul, doth not he know? And shall not he render to every man according to his works? Excuses for not doing well under the terms of Christian well-doing in the work of the gospel. Remember those that were scattered abroad under the persecutions of Saul of Tarsus. Fleeing in the midst of their persecutions, they went everywhere preaching the gospel, it says. Excuses, may God have mercy on our generation of Christians, my friends. For the one thing that they're expert in is excusing themselves from the duty of their Christian calling. That doesn't mean that they won't expend energy, but they'll expend it according to what pleases and glorifies and gratifies the flesh, the body, and not what accompanies the commitment of the soul unto the Lord their God. It's not easy. None of the exhortations of the Bible are easy to our souls. That's why they're rightly termed exhortations. They're things that stir us up. Surely Peter has made clear enough the alternative to the narrow way and to the hill difficulty. What shall the end be to them that obey not the gospel? Where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? One last word then. It's Peter's title and description of the God then to whom we are to commit our souls in well-doing. Of course, he's called a faithful creator. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful creator. Now again, that's a good word surely that Peter uses. God is our creator. He's the creator of his people, of course, of his church, of his household. He's that in a twofold sense. In the old creation, as far as the body goes, but in the new creation as well, as far as their renewed souls go. We are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works. And of course, one aspect of God as our creator is this, that not only did he create the world, but he upholds the world that he creates. He sustains it, he keeps it. Keeps the oceans and the skies and all things in his hand. If he can do that with the old creation, then surely it goes without saying that he can do it with the new. You see that Peter doesn't only call him a creator, but a faithful creator. Not only is God great enough to keep us, who created us, but he's good enough to keep us as well, for he's a faithful creator. We need reminded of that time and time again. We need reminded of it so that when the whole old creation seems in some kind of a convulsions around us, we're still able to commit our souls into the hands of our faithful creator, to come to the point of Job, in fact, and to say that though he slay me, yet shall I trust in him, for he is faithful. You know how we sometimes hurt our children when we're doing them good. If they go out and get a great big cut in their knee, and we have to hook out the wound, it hurts them. And we have to ask them to trust us that we're doing them good. That's what Peter's driving at. In the midst of all this, he says, remember it's the will of God. Commit your souls into his hands. Whose hands? Into the hands of a creator. Into the hands of your faithful creator. And of course, it's good that he tells them to commit their souls there. For again, the thing that is under threat is their bodies. Well, even their bodies. And when men do the worst to their bodies, when they drive their bodies into the grave where they turn to dust again, Well, the God, the Creator, who formed their bodies from dust in the first place, can reform their bodies in the resurrection out of dust again. Let them commit their souls to Him. And someday, when God's time has run its course, then their souls will come back with their bodies again, and they shall stand before the Lord. You know what they did with old John Wycliffe? They dug up his corpse, his old rotten body, and they hung it on a gallows. They hung his body. Then they chopped it to pieces. Then they burnt it. Then they scattered the ashes in the midst of a river. What did that do to John Wycliffe? John Wycliffe was absent from the body and present with the Lord. And having committed his soul into the hands of a faithful Creator, mattered not what happened to the body, for He who formed the body would reform it and reunite it with his soul forever and ever. That woman Abigail spoke a lovely word once to David. David, you remember, had gone out and did many things to the glory of the name of the Lord. The Lord had told him he would have a sure house. He was engaged in well-doing, you see, for the glory of the Lord. Now all his enemies were coming upon him, and Abigail comes out to meet him. Here's what she says. Yet a man is risen to pursue thee, she says, and to seek thy soul. But the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God, and the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling. How graphic that is. Sobering, comforting, however the words apply to us. You see that word that he uses? It's like, or she uses rather, like the word of Peter. And the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling. Grasp that, my friend. What has Peter asked? Where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Where shall they appear? Because they'll be flung out into outer darkness. When you wanted to sling a stone, the farther you wanted to sling it, that was according to the place that you set it in the sling. And when you wanted to sling that stone the farthest of all, you set that stone right in the middle of the sling. So shall God do with the enemies of those that are interested in his household. He shall sling them out as a stone from the middle of a sling, out into outer darkness. Where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? And the comfort, but the soul of my Lord, she says, that is the soul of David, but the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God. A bundle, you know what a bundle is? A bundle is something that you make up of all different things into one place for safekeeping. You tie it tightly. And that's what David is being done with, or is being done with David rather. The Lord's tying up all his life in a bundle to hold it securely. And Abigail speaks the word well to David. Surely she speaks it very well. When she speaks of his enemies being slung out like a stone out of the midst of a sling. It was a good few years ago, my friends, that young David took up a sling and slew the greatest enemy that had set himself against Israel, Goliath of Gath, with a sling and a stone. And the Lord's people, whatever the sufferings, whatever the hardships, whatever the persecutions, whatever might come upon the church, whatever perplexities, whatever valleys she is called to pass through, my friends, as the household of God, and taking our place in the household of God, and committing our souls unto God in well-doing, we can rest assured that our souls are in the hands of Him who created and keeps and ties all things up securely for the glory of His own name at the end of the day. The fiery trial, indeed it's coming. Think it not strange. Embrace the doctrine, the Bible's doctrine of being persecuted for righteousness' sake. From the example of Christ Himself, right down to the Father's hand upon the children that He loves, trace all these things, and when you've done it all, wherefore? Let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to Him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator. May we do so to the glory of God's name.